This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
And later on, the country's racial wealth divide.
But first,
we've heard that there is a growing gap between the very wealthy and everyone else. What does wealth inequality sound like? The sound that you are about to hear is a BB falling into a metal soup pot. Each BB represents $500 in net worth. If we took all the private wealth in the United States and divided it evenly among all the 100 million households, each household's share would sound like this. That was the sound of 500 BBs, the equivalent of about $250,000 for every household. But as you know, wealth is not evenly distributed. If we were to take the wealth of the bottom 50 million households and average it out, here is what it would sound like. That was 10 BBs, the sound representing $5,000. On the other end of the spectrum, let's listen to the average wealth of the richest 1% of households. To join the richest 1%, you need to have about $2.6 million or more. Here's what their share of wealth sounds like. That was the sound of wealth inequality, where the richest 1% of households has an average of $10 million and the average 50 million households in the bottom, over half the population, has an average of $5,000 in net worth.
And now, racial and economic inequality are the most pressing social issues of our time. In the last decade, we have seen the catastrophic economic impact of the Great Recession and an ensuing recovery that has been bypassed for millions of Americans, especially households of color. A new report looks at the country's racial wealth gap, finding that if current public policies stay the same, it will take more than two centuries for black families to accumulate the same amount of wealth that white families have today.
For the average Latino family, it takes 84 years.
Building Bridges is now going to focus on the essential role that wealth plays in achieving financial security and opportunity. And we have with us Diedrich Asante Mohammed, director of the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative at the Corporation for Enterprise Development.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I'm overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed going back to the sound of the BBs, which I think is a brilliant piece to display wealth inequality. But we're going to hone in even more specifically on the issue of wealth inequality and its impact on race and racism in this country. Now,
yeah, and I don't know if you mentioned that Chuck Collins, I believe, was the one who narrated that.
He was he was. Thank you for appropriately crediting him, indeed. So the average black family would need 228 years to build the wealth of a white family today? Wow.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, I think what the report's trying to highlight is that I think oftentimes we have in our heads that, you know, a lot has been done around racial inequality. There's truth to that. But there's also this belief that, you know, even though things might not be going as fast as people would like, you know, we are headed toward equality and we'll eventually get there. But what this report is highlighting is, no, we are not on a path for greater racial economic inequality. And without racial economic inequality, you will not have racial equity. And again, you know, no one wants white wealth to freeze for 228 years. So I don't think anyone can say that we're even on a path, even a slow path, of racial economic inequality between blacks and whites or Latinos and whites, where it's about a little over 80 years if white wealth froze. We don't expect or want white wealth to freeze. We want some type of movement where blacks and Latinos are moving up at a significant enough rate that we can get to some type of wealth equity and even most importantly, some type of financial sustainability. for Black and Latino households, because the median wealth of Black and Latino households is way too low to have any type of financial stability today.
Now, one of the determinants of wealth is, of course, income, but you're taking this a step further, and it brings us to many of the questions that we haven't been addressing about African Americans in the economy. How did this disparity of wealth, how is that created aside from just inequality of income?
Yeah, sure. I mean, income, and, you know, African Americans make about 60 cents for every dollar whites make, so that definitely hurts, and Latinos make around that as well. Unemployment disparities, that's true as well. African Americans have had twice the unemployment rate of whites since 1963, so that is an issue that builds on that. But you're right, wealth isn't just income. Wealth is also, you know, is your assets, right? And it's your, for most Americans, the majority of your wealth is in your home. African Americans and Latinos have 45 to 41% home ownership rates, while whites have a 71% home ownership rate. So that's a huge disparity there. Also, what you find is that with wealth, and you know, wealth is oftentimes multi-generation. And so it is very challenging to build wealth in one generation. It's oftentimes something that, you know, you develop a little of and you invest into your children, and that grows and that grows. But we haven't had an economy, as African Americans have had more opportunity in terms of employment, in terms of income. We've seen an economy where over the last 30 years, over 90% of the wealth has gone to the richest 20% of Americans. So coming into a regressive economy that is mostly serving the wealthy, once African Americans and other racial groups receive greater civil rights, has made economic equity that much more of a challenge.
Diedrich, one of the things, just maybe continuing to some extent on Ken's question, the racial wealth gap, it seems to me, is how the past really shows up in the present. And I wonder if you can elaborate on that and flesh that out for us more.
Sure, sure. You know, and one thing a lot of people forget is that America, as a country with a, you know, strong middle class, a financially secure middle class that was looking to have each generation do better than the next, is a fairly recent phenomenon. It really didn't really begin into the 40s, 50s. And, you know, it began with, you know, strong government investments, whether it's through creating more home ownership opportunities and subsidizing home ownership, subsidizing higher education, and even strengthening public schools and having a very robust economy. That is what created an American middle class economy. And at that time, clearly in the 40s and 50s, it was an American white middle class economy. So strong investment, strong economy, and that created a white middle class economy. Now, it wasn't until, you know, we're getting into the 60s, 70s, and even today, we're fighting to remove racial barriers of opportunity for Blacks, Latinos, Native Americans. But we have an economy that is no longer as robust and without the type of investment into an American middle class economy. You know, one thing this report highlights is oftentimes people say, well, you know, to bridge these type of disparities, we don't have the type of money necessary to deal with those issues. And what we highlight is over $600 billion a year is invested in wealth development for households. The problem is the overwhelming majority of that money goes to the wealthiest of Americans. So we're spending over $600 billion a year in de facto, in a way, to strengthen wealth inequality and to help concentrate wealth among the wealthiest. So if we could turn right side up this upside down tax code where most of this investment occurs, we would have a powerful tool to help investing in those who've never had the opportunity and the legacy of a strong, you know, middle class financial stability.
Well, tell us some of the ways that could be changed and whether any of those instances are embodied in the programs of either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Just in terms of rhetoric, I have been surprised that Hillary Clinton has addresses racial inequality and notes it all throughout her Breaking the Barriers economic agenda. One thing I will note in that is she, you know, her big plan is $250 billion over 10 years. And I just noted how we spend over $600 billion a year in strengthening economic inequality or wealth inequality through an upside-down tax code. So clearly, we need something at a much larger scale to deal with these issues and really turn back that. You know, Donald Trump, you know, he does talk about the system's rigged, and he's right. And he does talk about, more so aimed at a white working class, that the idea that they're not getting their fair share, and he's right, they're not getting his fair share. But the challenge for Trump, one, Trump doesn't really have much detailed policy at all, so it's hard to kind of pin him down on anything. But many of his top advisors and even the tax program he's put forward seems to only further reward the wealthiest Americans and would probably do more to strengthen wealth inequality than to support that white working class base that he has so strongly. So those are challenges around both candidates. You know, but, you know, and some things he's even talking about even making worse, like the estate tax. He calls it death tax. He wants to get rid of that. But, of course, you only have to pay the death tax, or really the estate tax, if you have an estate over $5 million. Well, clearly, most Americans are nowhere near that. And so what you're really talking about doing is saving more money for the wealthiest Americans. So there are clearly some very regressive things tied up in some of Trump's policies that wouldn't get the country going in the right direction.
Diedrich Asante-Mohammed, I want to take it further then. So how does the racial wealth gap actually provide a rationale for reparations?
Well, I mean, yes. So clearly the fact that, and I think, you know, reparations historically, you know, 40 acres and a mule, what have you, has always been this recognition that you cannot get to equality without economic investment into these communities. And so 40 acres and a mule was a, you know, idea of reparations that was never fully enacted for, you know, anywhere near close to most African Americans. The call for reparations has always been about bridging economic inequality. It wasn't just trying to make someone pay because they did something wrong. It was about trying to get the country on an even plane so we get past the terrible history we've had. And we've never had it. You know, Martin Luther King talked about, you know, it was one thing to get people to take down white-only signs. It's another thing to get the country to invest billions of dollars into communities that they have so long neglected and assaulted in many ways. And so, you know, we oftentimes remember the victories of movements that we look positively upon today. And so we look, you know, and so we remember the voting rights victories and the anti-segregation victories, but we don't remember is the loss. We did not get the 1967 freedom budget. We did not get the fairly radical economic agenda that was being put forward by pretty mainstream civil rights leaders in the 60s. And because of that, we have not had the equity that we were hoping to get post the civil rights era.
Home ownership is one of the main ways that people basically accumulate wealth, people who aren't millionaires, that is. And African Americans have been traditionally discriminated against certain benefits which the white working class has gotten subsidizing home ownership. How would we begin to reverse that?
Well, I think, you know, one thing you can do is you can look at mortgage interest deductions. Like, again, you know, mortgage interest deductions is pretty much a tax subsidy that rewards people for home ownership. But the challenge is the more home you have, the more you spend on your home, the more you get out of this mortgage interest deduction. So what we really need is we need mortgage interest deduction, and probably not even a deduction, but a tax credit. So if you really hit lower income or moderate income people, we need a mortgage interest tax credit that is very limited and only goes to those who are, you know, having a home, only goes up to covering the value of a home up to maybe $250,000, $300,000 versus rewarding someone for having $1 million, million and a half dollar home. So that's one thing you can just make more regressive by bringing down the ceiling of the rewards for that and make sure it's a credit. So those who might not even do deductions, but, you know, would still get the benefit of that.
You know, I keep thinking of a picture that I have of a program for reparations as a sort of Marshall Plan for poor communities of color. But with that, I want to go back and talk about wealth as a predictor of a child's economic prospects to give our audience a full and comprehensive sense of the importance of this particular topic.
Yeah, no, that's a very important point. And I'm blanking on the man's name. It was Connolly. He wrote a important book.
Yes, it was.
15 years.
Dalton Connolly.
Is that his name?
Yes, Dalton Connolly, a sociologist from Princeton.
That's right. He helped highlight how, you know, you can look at African Americans and white Americans of the same household income and then look at their children. And you'll see that oftentimes white children will end up doing better at school, maybe even better professionally. But if you look at white households and black households of the same wealth, there you see that African-American children do as well, if not better. And again, it's because income is one thing, but income doesn't mean, you know, wealth is another that allows for stability in your finances. Again, if you lose your job or if there's a, you know, challenge or some great emergency cost, you don't have to go into debt to cover that cost. It also allows you to take advantage of opportunity. It allows you to, and you know, put your kid in an after-school program that might cost some money, or make sure that they have an opportunity to go to whatever school will accept them. So wealth, you know, much more so than income, is something that can really help identify for Americans how they're going to do in the future. And a great challenge is that, you know, today even a lot of people equate high income with high wealth. High income African Americans more often than not have less wealth than low income whites. Mm. And again, it's because that wealth has been something that's kind of accumulated over time, and debt is something that accumulates time. Because again, I always point out to people, it's one thing to be wealth poor individually from a household, but when your whole community is in asset poverty, what it takes to get out of that, because not only you're trying to help yourself and give your immediate family some support, but you're also helping maybe your mother or your grandfather who only has $15,000 in retirement and that only lasts them a year and a half. So you have to give money there, so you're not using the money you do have, even if you are high income, into developing wealth development that could help your children or even put money properly into your own retirement. So wealth inequality goes across the income lines of in the African American community, Latino community, and Native American community.
Returning to income as a determinant of wealth, what do you think the focus of the fight for 15 in a union, whole question of the exorbitant bank fees, P&A lending, all kinds of things that have to do with income also determining wealth?
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly, again, like, income doesn't determine wealth, but you sure can't develop wealth if you're very, very low income. So I think that working to fight for greater living wages is a very important piece. It's really a beginning step in wealth development, because clearly if you can't pay your bills, you can't then set aside money to develop wealth or put aside money to invest in wealth. And then we got to deal with these wealth stripping things, like you're saying, predatory lending. That's something where, you know, like you're trying to make a, you had to take a payday loan, and now not only are you have to pay off, you know, that debt, but that ridiculous interest of 400-500%, that money's taking away the opportunity to use any extra money you might have had to put into a savings account or what have you. So definitely wealth stripping's been a huge problem, and African American community, Latino community, and the Asian American community felt that strongly during the Great Recession in terms of loss of wealth in homes with the crash of the housing crisis and with Blacks and Latinos being targeted for subprime lending.
You know, you've just a moment ago really deflated the mythology that the racial wealth gap has anything to do with the fact of presumably living in meritocracy. But in the remaining moments that we have, the policy interventions that you would suggest to address the growing crisis?
Yes, and I think that's why your point again, that people have such a hard time dealing with this issue, because it really does shake up this understanding that, well, if you just work hard, if you just do right, then you know, things will work out and we'll all kind of have a equal opportunity in this country. But again, I mean, some of the major policies, I mean, clearly we need to, one thing we put forward is we need to have what we call a racial wealth divide audit, is that when we have federal policies, when we had the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, there needed to be analysis at the front end about, we're going to create this many jobs, this many million jobs. Well, we're going to make sure that they get to communities of very high unemployment, like African American, Latino, Native American communities. So there needs to be racial wealth divide audit of big federal investments or even big state investments to make sure these policies and programs are reaching the communities that are most hurting. And then again, I know we're running out of time. I'll just highlight again the upside down tax code. You know, we have $230 billion in the tax code to support home ownership, $230 that boosts savings and investment, another $172,000 to support retirement. But all of these things disproportionately go to higher income people. We need to change these tax policies, make sure they're make sure they're credits, and make sure they're aimed at moderate income, lower income Americans, so we can help develop their financial stability and not just be a cherry on top for the richest Americans.
And what about an account for infants to begin with?
Oh, that's true. That's something the organization CFED, Corporation for Enterprise Development, has been fighting for a long time around these ideas of a child savings account. And people like Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton have pushed for even kind of stronger accounts they call baby bonds. This idea that that every American, when they're born, a certain amount of money, maybe $10,000, is put aside for a child, and kind of like a Social Security piece where it's an investment that would give returns, and maybe when they're 18 or 25 or some age, then the youth would have access to this to help them for a down payment for a house, to help them for a trade school, to help them for college. And I do think that just as we needed new type of innovative social welfare programs to create the American middle class economy of the past, we're going to need some new innovative social welfare programs of the future to help ensure that America continues to have a 21st century American middle class economy that for the first time will be racially inclusive.
Well, we actually have about a minute left. So since there hasn't been any real discussion amongst the candidates, including the candidates such as Bernie Sanders and indeed even the Green Party and certainly the Libertarian Party, the issue of poverty at this juncture, how do we really address and reshape and rebuild a social service safety net to shore up the poor as we look at this broader question of the racial wealth divide and bridging the gap, so to speak?
Sure. And the Corporation for Enterprise Development was founded, actually, with the idea of looking at asset development, wealth development to address the problems of the poor, those in poverty. So, I mean, asset development, wealth development is important to the middle class. It's even important to high-income African-American and Latinos who are low wealth. But it's very important to those living in poverty, and some type of child savings account would really create incredible new opportunities for those type of communities. If people want to learn more about some of these issues, they can check out our Bridging the Racial Wealth Divide Facebook page. We put up articles and best practices from across the country daily so people can learn more about those issues. And we have a Race and Wealth podcast that people can just Google Race and Wealth, and we talk to local practitioners and national experts on these issues. So thanks so much for having this conversation with me today.
And thank you for adding broader dimensions to the issues that Black Lives Matter, and for tuning us into this most critical, most pressing social issue of our time, and that is the impact of the Great Recession, the ensuing poverty, and the enormity of the racial wealth divide. And we've got a lot of work to do to make sure that indeed it is not, how many years did I say? 228 years to build the wealth. The average Black family would need 228 years to build the wealth of a white family today. Wow. We've been speaking with Diedrich Asante Muhammad, director of the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative at the Corporation for Enterprise Development. Go to their website. Lots more information. We need to put this on our agenda and begin the work forthwith.
This is for all you big government Wall Street types.
And now let's listen to Mike Stout.
Well, I was watching TV at election time. There were two candidates trying to lay it on the line. One of them looked like he was training to be cute. He was a white man in a business suit. I looked at the other, he was equally astute. He was a white man in a business suit. Well, they kept on talking, they didn't make sense. They both seemed to be on the same side of the fence. There was no real debate, it was a phony dispute. They were just two white men in business suits. If you
the U.S., Europe, and Russia, too. He's a white man in a business suit. Sued by a lawyer, he was after my loot. He was a white man in a business suit. I got fired by my boss cause I wouldn't lick his boots. He was a white man in a business suit. I got evicted by my landlord cause my rent was overdue. He was a white man in a business suit. I got rejected for a loan at the financial institute by a white man in a business suit. I tried talking to my congressman, he didn't give a hoot. He was a white man in a business suit. Well, there's a whole lot of things I'd rather do than be a white man in a business suit. I'd rather be ragged with holes in my shoes than be a white man in a business suit. Yeah! His control to be absolute, from Exxon to Chrysler to United Fruit. He's a white man in a business suit.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.